Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with the Survival Podcast. Welcome to an episode of Friday Flashbacks. After 15 years and hundreds of interview shows, we decided to run them as flashbacks every Friday. Beginning with the oldest of them and going forward, there's a tremendous library of wisdom in all the great interviews we've done over the years. So sit back and enjoy. Whether this is your first time or even your second time around with today's episode, I'm sure you will enjoy it and learn a lot from it. And remember, you can help support the Survival Podcast and the work we do just by becoming a member of the Survival Podcast Members Support Brigade. If you do that, you'll get access to over 70 awesome discount codes on products and services you likely already use. Things like seeds, cannabis products, food storage items, custom roasted coffee, and even cool stuff like ammo and moonshine stills and more. So support the show, get all your money back and more. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more and sign up. Now let's get into today's Friday Flashback. And today we are flashing back right about 13 years. This was originally June the 14th, 2011. It was episode 684. And it was Keith Snow, Chef Keith Snow, on cooking with grains, legumes, and other preps. It's interesting over the years how as my diet has moved to much more of a carnivorous diet, how I have less interest in this. But this is actually a really important subject because what Keith was really talking about in this episode is, yeah, you can eat what you store and store what you eat if you eat carbohydrates and things like that. But many preppers, even that don't eat a lot of that type of a diet, know that things like beans, lentils, whole grains like whole wheat store for like 25 years, no trouble if they're properly stored. So it's a great emergency ration. Well, but what are you going to do with it? I'll figure it out when the time comes. You might want to know in advance. Yeah? Anyway, this will be a great episode. Real quick before we drop you into it, I want to remind you about the item of the day because I had three cool things this week. And I want to give you a little recap of them. So we have the collapsible rain barrels and bladders, water storage bladders from Vivor. Those are awesome. We also have the emergency air compressors that are about the size of a brick, like a brick you would build a wall with. Not a cinder block, like a regular like hand-sized brick. And, you know, you can not be trapped on the side of the road. And those can also power and charge your wireless devices. And they have that reserve battery capacity. Plus, they have a power cord that will plug into, like, your 12-volt cigarette lighter plug. So even if the battery died because you didn't keep an eye on it, you're not stuck on the side of the road because that cord is plenty long enough, standard-sized vehicles, to reach all four wheels. So you got that. Then today I'm bringing something to you that I was going to wait till next week since I've already brought you two Vivor products this week, but it just came back in stock and it's on sale at 24% off, the 10-inch meat slicer. This is a product that I brought you last year before I was even working directly with Vivor. It's actually how I found Vivor was this product. Nicole Sauce owns the same exact meat slicer. When she saw it here in the fall, she's like, oh, I have that same one. And it's just awesome. It's like a comparable slicer from like another company, costs a couple hundred bucks more, but right now this thing is stupid cheap. It's barely over $200. Let me tell you something about meat slicers, guys. They pay for themselves. Look, if you buy deli meat at all, look at the price of deli meat, then look at like going to Costco and buying like a whole honey ham and slicing it yourself, or go buy an eye of round and do that as a roast beef, medium, of course, or even a little bit less done in your oven, good seasoning. Let it cool, throw it on a slicer, and look at what roast beef costs versus that, and it's better. And you can do that with so many different things. If you're into curing meats, like hard sausages and stuff, this is a must-have. These things are great, and it's just a hair over $200 today. Remember, you can always get 5% off everything at Vivor with my discount code, and you can find all the information about all this stuff. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, scroll down, you'll see the most recent reviewed items, or go to tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. You'll find all the Vivor items, all the Amazon items, all the reviews categorized in the different categories and everything there. I own it. I spent my money on it, or I wouldn't recommend that you do the same. With that, let's go ahead and drop back in 6/14/11, episode 684, Keith Snow on Cooking with Your Preps. So with that, let's go ahead and get into the main topic of today's show. All right, folks, as I said during the introduction segment, we are really fortunate and happy to bring back one of our best guests, of most requested guests of all time, Chef Keith Snow, who talks, of course, about cooking seasonally, cooking locally, and today about cooking with your preps and cooking in general as a skill set. That's what Keith's going to talk to us about today. Keith, of course, is well-known for his website, harvesteating.com. He's also a sponsor of the show. And Keith, welcome back to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, Jack, thanks so much for having me back on again.
Well, I mean, like I said, you every time we do a show with you, it's a big hit, and I wanted to definitely make sure you were part of this interview blitz I'm doing while I'm, you know, taking my well-earned vacation, as I see it. So folks are listening to this from the past, so to speak. So one of the things I wanted to do was have you on today to talk about cooking with things that are common in our preps, and we kind of chatted before we got started here today about what some of those things are. We did quite a bit about grains in the past, but I'd like to touch on that one again if I could with you, because there's so many people that are sitting there with these huge buckets full of like hard wheat, red wheat, white wheat, spring wheat, what have you, maybe even some barley and things like that, and they're planning on if doomsday comes, there's food there and it's great nutrition. But if you've ever thrown a handful of wheat berries in your mouth and started chewing, you're probably missing a tooth or two. So what should people be doing now to learn how to use that grain and make it part of their diets today? Because they do it all around the world, right? I mean, there's places where that is the mainstay of the diet, but as Americans, we've lost that skill. So what are some ideas for cooking with your whole grains?
Yeah, well, I guess we have a lot of that too, sitting in our sunroom. I continuously order grains into my own, you know, farmstead, and we put them up like your listeners do. Well, first thing is, you wouldn't be surprised how many people have, bags and bags of long-term wheat berries, but nobody has a grinder. I mean, definitely, invest in a grinder. And then, of course, you're going to want to learn how to make, bread. And making, you know, 100% whole wheat bread can definitely take a little practice and some trickery to get it to rise properly. So the first thing I would say is make sure you have a grinder and make sure you know how to make the flour and start doing some blends. Like you can use some store-bought bread flour and practice making bread. That would be the first thing. But then, you know, back to just the wheat berries, I think the last time I was on, I talked about using them as a cereal. They do make a great cereal, and you can cook them both in water or milk and definitely add a pinch of salt in there, and you can certainly sweeten it with any number of sugars, brown sugar, you can use coconut, palm sugar, honey, maple syrup, whatever it might be. It makes a great cereal, but also think of it as a dessert too, because a lot of times in Mediterranean countries and even some of the Arab countries, they use wheat berries and they make desserts out of it. So you can do like a pudding and think of a rice pudding, but use these wheat berries. They make a really great rich and hearty sort of a pudding, and you can do that again by cooking them in milk, and once they start to soften up, and it can take a while, these hard wheat berries, you know, they need somewhere of 25 minutes or more to really get tender, and once all that milk is absorbed, you can, a lot of people don't know, like if you cook rice or beans or wheat berries, just because they absorb all the liquid that you put in there, that doesn't mean that they can't absorb even more liquid. So once they're cooked down and they're tender, you can put more milk back in, and then you can enrich them with eggs. And you have to make sure that you don't just dump the scrambled eggs, or you don't dump the whipped up eggs right into the hot wheat berries, because you can scramble them and that would be disgusting. But let's say you cook these wheat berries down, they've absorbed all the milk or even the water. Now you can add a bunch more, like maybe, let's say you're dealing with 3 or 4 cups of wheat berries. You could put in at least 4 cups of whole milk. And once you add that in there, then you can put in your whipped up eggs. You can put in a little bit of vanilla and maybe a touch of cinnamon, and then stir that up and cook that even further. And once you have that thing completely cooked and a lot of that new milk is absorbed in there, you're going to have sort of a loose pudding, and that is an awesome thing. You can take that, you can serve it hot, certainly in the winter, or you can take an aluminum sheet tray or any type of cookie tray and dump it out onto the cookie tray and sort of level it out so it's even, and the aluminum is a great transfer material for heat and cold. So if you put that into the refrigerator, it'll cool it off really quickly, much quicker than if you put a whole pot of them in there, which would be really dense. So once you have that thing cooled off, if you make a lot of it, you can certainly freeze it in zip bags. But once you have it cooled off, then you can layer it with fresh fruit. And it makes an incredible sort of thick, hearty dessert. And what we like to do is take creme fraiche, which we make at home. There's a recipe on the Harvest Eating website. And we layer it almost like a parfait in sort of a, you know, like a margarita glass or any type of tall glass. A little bit of the wheat berry pudding mixture, some fresh blueberries, a little creme fraiche, and then another layer and so on and so forth. And top it off with some whipped cream or even some mascarpone cheese, maybe a little bit of mint. And you've got a really great, very hearty. Remember, wheat berry is a whole grain, so the grain has not been, it hasn't been, you know, deconstructed. It still has the endosperm and all the bran and the real healthy, slow energy release stuff is still in there. So that makes a really great either hot or cold dessert. And another place that you can use wheat berries, which is awesome, and I actually haven't done it in a while. I used to do it out in Colorado, is take some, like a lot of people are cooking with beef, and let's just say you make something where you have beef bones. You can take those beef bones and you put them in a stock pot, fill it up with cold water and some aromatics like a mirepoix, celery, carrot, and onion, a little bit of herbs, and bring that up to a simmer, and don't let it boil because you'll get a real cloudy stock. And cook that for a good long time, maybe 2 hours. Strain that liquid out, and then once you have that, you can use that as a base, and you can make a soup out of it. Now think, you've got a beef stock. You can add a bunch of vegetables. Again, a mirepoix. You can even add things like green onions in there, carrots, and then put in wheat berries and cook those in there. You don't want it to be super thick, almost like the consistency of a barley soup, but you can use the wheat berries. And again, the beef stock will absorb into the wheat berries, and you've got a really great soup. And that can be done conversely with seafood or with chicken, and it's a really terrific thing to have, very filling, very hearty. I personally like it with beef. And, you know, what I used to do when I was out in Colorado, I had access to 12 restaurants that I ran, so I would take beef bones home and I would, you know, roll a good stock and make some real dark, hearty beef stock. I'd use it for French onion soup, but I'd also make this wheat berry soup, and it's really delicious.
You know, Keith,
definitely give it a try.
You know what, Keith? The next time that I schedule you for an interview at 11 a.m., tell me no, and let's do it at 1 p.m. my time, so I've eaten lunch before I let you talk about something as simple as using wheat. Every time I have you on the show, man, you just make me hungry and you make me want to go cook something. So, folks, those of you that thought, like, if you ever have to live on your wheat stalks, you're going to be forced to just sit around eating basically porridge or stewed wheat. Here's just a couple examples of what you can do. And then the last time I had Keith on, he talked a great deal more about whole grains. And I'll put a link to that prior interview for those of you who haven't seen it. I want to kind of move on now. The staples, I've always told people, of the long-term food storage that you don't have to go buy cases of Mountain House to do are rice, beans, and pasta. And you were wanting to talk about those, so I think it's great synergy there. Let's start out with rice. And if you want to mix the beans back into the rice, the pasta and the rice, don't let me hold you there. But let's start out with something we can do with all that rice. We have buckets of it. So what are we going to do with it so that we're not waiting for the apocalypse to use that great nutrition that's sitting out there?
Well, one thing that's I find interesting is, you know, a lot of people are stocking up, and as you know, your audience is growing, mine, and people are wondering what they can do to have redundancy, like you were talking about in one of your recent shows. Now, let's just say you've got all this rice there. I mean, that's a level of redundancy, but if you don't know how to use it and you're not doing what you do, what you preach is you know, eat what you store, store what you eat. If you're not doing that, you're missing a level of redundancy. So by practicing cooking with your preps, I think is really important. And a lot of people are buying the foods that come from the food storage companies, and I don't discourage people of doing that at all, but I also feel like just like you said, beans and rice and wheat berries on our own without having to go through a company, that stuff is pretty expensive. Just by learning how to cook and learning, like I just mentioned with the wheat berries, you got a bunch of ideas there. I'm going to give you a bunch of ideas now for rice and a bunch of ideas for pasta and beans. All of a sudden, with just having a decent pantry, you can make your own long-term storage because you've got the base ingredients, these relatively inexpensive carbohydrates, and then if you're learning to cook with them and you can make some great foods, you don't have to rely on the companies to put together the meals. You can make them yourself. So let's talk about rice. I mean, one of the great things with rice is it's such an international thing, and if you kind of forget about, just white rice with butter, as a side dish, if you try thinking about some of the ethnic foods that are made with rice, all of a sudden you're opening up a whole new kind of, what I call culinary inventory of dishes. And let's talk about paella. Paella is a really interesting dish. It's very simple, and it can use just about any protein source. Let's say you've got venison. Let's say you live near a stream and you've got seafood, or if you're raising rabbits, or you've got chicken. You can use a basic paella recipe for anything, and it's going to be best with like a long grain rice. And what you do with paella, what they have are these paella pans, but if you don't have a paella pan, which is a wide sort of flat pan, any large stock pot or something wide, even a deep saute pan will work for this. But what you do to make a paella, you take some a little bit of butter and some good olive oil, and then you actually want to fry the rice. So once you heat that up, you'll put the rice right into the fat, the olive oil and butter. You certainly could use lard as well. And once you start to fry the rice, you'll see that and you got to move it around a lot because it can burn pretty easily. But if you're tossing it around, you want to crisp up the grains. And they do this a lot in Spanish cuisine and in Mexican cuisine. So once the rice starts to get a little color on it, then you're going to add a bunch of aromatics. And again, the sky is the limit here. You can go just with a standard mirepoix, which I talked about. You can go with like an assortment of bell peppers. You could go with, if it's the summer, zucchini and squash, onions, carrots, all types of aromatic vegetables. Give those a quick saute, and then what you're going to do is pour on stocks. And like I mentioned before, you can make a beef stock. You can make chicken broth. You can make, seafood. Any type of stock, you fill the pan up, and you want to cover the rice, and then you're going to season it well with herbs and salt and pepper. And a lot of times what they use is saffron, which is a fairly expensive spice, but it goes a long way. And for people that don't know, saffron are the threads of crocus flowers, and they're picked by hand, and that's why they're so expensive, that there's no mechanized way to get those little threads out. But you can put a little bit of saffron. That would be very traditional. And then the whole thing will cook down. The liquid will evaporate off. The rice will absorb the liquid. And in the end, you've got sort of like a rice stew. And if you get creative and you have a lot of vegetables in there, let's say you make it with chicken. You've got pieces of chicken. This is a great place to use the dark meat cuts, like thighs and drumsticks, debone them and put those in there. And you've got a really flavorful type of like a rice stew, which is this paella. And you can make it spicy. You can do anything with it. And you can use, like I said, any protein. That's a really great one. I love a paella, and I actually have a paella pan that I got in France.
Yeah, that's an awesome dish. I'm glad to hear you talk about it. One thing I want to reiterate for people, though, is, like, if you're from America and you haven't ever made this for yourself, you probably but you know what it is. It's probably because you've gone to, like, a Portuguese restaurant and they made it for you. It seems like this high-end thing that only some kind of ethnic restaurant can put together. But where it's from, it's peasant food. It's something everybody does all the time because it's their equivalent of something like a jambalaya. Whatever we have around protein-wise goes into that basic recipe. But it is phenomenal. Again, you're killing me like you always do. Now I want to go home and cook wheat porridge and paella. But please continue on. I just wanted to bring that up, that it's not as complex as you maybe have led to believe by the restaurant that puts a half a lobster on it and sells it for $50 a plate.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention that because, you know, coming from the restaurant business and being a chef, we used to laugh when we would get, you know, $19 and $22 for a bowl of risotto, which is, it's like you said, it's peasant food. And over there in these cultures, us chefs have a great tradition of poaching these peasant recipes that use, you know, almost free. I mean, when you're in the restaurant business, rice and things like that are very inexpensive. And to turn it into this sort of fancy ethnic meal that we can charge $25 a plate, it's always the long-standing joke in the kitchen, but it's a great point. These are not dishes that royalty would make. These are the dishes that the real rural type folks in Europe and you know, and even in Eastern Europe, these type of dishes are super inexpensive and very easy. You don't need fancy techniques. You know, frying rice in oil, this is not very complicated. So that's an excellent point. Another thing, think of like Puerto Rican food and South American food. One of the great dishes is arroz con pollo. And it's basically chicken and rice. But if you do it right and you really remember that a lot of these, you know, like Puerto Rican and Cuban and even Mexican, what makes that type of cuisine, you know, that Central and South American cuisine, what makes it so great is the Spanish influence. So let's kind of make some arroz con pollo right in our mind here. And again, this is a good place to use those cheaper cuts of chicken. And I heard a story on I think it was Marketplace. It's an NPR program. And they're talking about Americans are so used to just white meat, you know, pork, the other white meat, that the warehouses are so filled up with dark meat, you know, chicken thighs.
Which, let me interject, I think is insane, because if you give me a choice between a grilled piece of chicken thigh or a grilled piece of chicken breast, I'm going to take the thigh every day. That breast is juicy the second it comes off the grill. You have leftovers tomorrow morning, it not so much. And the flavor's better, too.
Yeah, no, that's an excellent point. The breast is the least flavorful part, and they charge the most for it. And what's happened is a lot of these foreign countries are hurting so bad that the exports of these, you know, they usually just serve the Americans the overpriced white breast and then ship the undesirables to the people in Asia who are smart enough to eat it. But this is a great place to use that stuff. And let's just say you're going to do it with drumsticks and thighs. You want to keep the bone in and skin on. What you're going to do is take like a Dutch oven, and again, you're going to start out with some olive oil over about a medium heat. And what you can do is take the chicken, and I sell these spice blends, but you can use whatever type of a spice blend that you like. But take the chicken and dredge it in flour, right? Just take some flour, add your spices, kind of dredge it in there, shake it off, and then put it down in the oil. And you'll need a good bit, maybe a quarter inch of oil in the bottom. Don't be afraid of the oil. Put the chicken in there, and the secret here is you cannot have it on high heat, because if you do, the skin is going to burn, and you're not going to create the caramelization that you want. So over a low to maybe slightly medium heat, put your chickens in a single layer. Lay them down in there, your thighs with the skin on, your breast. And these are, like I said, they're seasoned already. They got a touch of flour on them. Put them down in the oil and don't touch them. They only need to be turned once. If you sit there and scrape them and play with them and all that, you're just going to completely miss it. The entire thing with this dish, the technique that us chefs would have the discipline to do, is not to touch it. So let it cook until you can visibly see a really darker than you would imagine, a nice dark crust starting to appear on the bottom of that chicken. That's creating intense flavor. So once you've got that really golden brown, flip it over one time and do the exact same thing on the other side. Once you've got both sides really good and caramelized and brown, take those off out of the pan and just put them on some paper towels to rest. Now you've got chicken fat in the pan because the skin is going to render out a lot of chicken fat. Now you've got an awesome, and you've probably got some burnt bits on there, which is great. We'll talk about those in a minute. But now what you want to do is take either a red or a Spanish white onion, and you want that thing minced up really fine. You're going to throw that down into the oil, You're also going to throw down a good bit, maybe 4 to 6 cloves of minced garlic, and throw that in there. And you want to stir this mixture up and, you know, keep it going in the pan. And again, you want these to get translucent on the way to becoming caramelized, but you don't need to really cook them that long. And then I would throw in there an assortment of good quality olives. And you could use black and some green olives. Throw that in there. And then what you're going to want to do is take, I would say, a bit of stock, like a chicken stock, and you're going to put about 2 cups of it in there, and that's going to deglaze the pan. When you put that in there, you're going to hear a lot of sizzling and steaming. Scrape the bits up off the bottom of the pan, and then you're going to add your rice to that. And I'll give you a recipe for this, Jack, that way people don't have to worry about the amounts. You'll add your rice in there. Now you've got aromatics. You've got the olives, which are very traditional to Spanish cooking. You can put in some of that saffron, and then you take your chicken, you nestle it down in the rice, and then you're going to, you know, fill it up with your chicken broth, and then you're going to cover that thing and cook it for a good long time until all the rice is fluffy and the chicken is going to finish cooking in there. It'll probably take a good 25 to 30 minutes for this to happen, maybe even a little longer on low key. And then you've got arroz con pollo. What you're going to want to do when you uncover it, you're going to take some fresh cilantro that you've minced up along with some fresh Italian parsley, and you're going to take that and throw it right on the top, and then take some good, this is where you use your good olive oil, and this is your good drizzling olive oil. Don't use any of that sort of clear, cheap, pure oil. Use a good extra virgin oil and drizzle that on the top, and then mix all the herbs and the oil up in there and serve that thing on a plate, and people go nuts for that because it's got that really earthy flavor with the onion and the chicken and all the olives in there. Arroz con pollo can be an incredible recipe. And if you guys just search on the internet, you'll find zillions of different variations. One that I really like to do is to put roasted red peppers in there. When you put in the aromatics, you can put in a couple of roasted bell peppers that are diced up. That really adds a nice flavor. But again, chicken thighs and legs, drumsticks and thighs are cheap. I mean, you can get a couple of packs of these things for $6 or $7. The rice is super cheap. You know, you're only adding maybe a dollar or two worth of olives, a little bit of oil, and you can cook a one pot meal that will knock people's socks off. And I would
unbelievable thing. You're taking me back to the early 1990s in my time in Panama, and every time I went into a Panamanian household, I don't care what else was going on, there was always a pot of arroz con pollo. And every person that cooked this dish in Panama was convinced theirs was the best, and they had their own secret recipe, and it was all similar with subtle nuances of differences, and it was all freaking awesome. And again, it's peasant food, but yet you'll go into an expensive restaurant and get basically the same thing and pay $20 a plate for it. And a lot of people won't really resent doing it because it's such a fabulous dish. But even if you buy whole chickens, right? So if you want to do something with the breast, you break that breast off, and then you take your quarters and your back and your neck and everything, and you use it to create this.
Right. You know, that's a great point. And one of the points that's really salient is that everyone has their own. So everyone's grandma makes the best, you know, Latin grandma makes the best arroz con pollo. And that's what you should really play around with. But this is it's a great way to use up your preps, your rice, and then to take a well-stocked pantry. Remember, olives, canned olives, they don't need to be, you know, you don't need to go to Whole Foods, to the olive bar where they really rip you off. You can use canned and bottled olives that store for years and years.
Absolutely.
Essentially, they're loaded with salt and vinegar. These things almost have an eternal shelf life.
So yeah, I mean, let's remember, olives, figs, and dates are the original prepper pantry when there was no refrigeration and people had to make a living off the edges of deserts.
That's right. Yeah, all these things store really well. And you know, what scares me, I mean, who knows what the future brings, but what scares me is a life where, you know, our listeners are eating this number 10 can dehydrated swill, because to me, I mean, I'd rather die than have to live like that. To me, you know, like having spices in your pantry,
yeah,
and these little subtleties, olives and things like that, these are critical to life's enjoyment. And if it does come to that point, man, we're not going to be getting our enjoyment from, you know, video games and going to a local restaurant. We're going to want to at least have good food. So that's another great dish. Another one we talked about earlier is risotto, and that's what I call a great harvest eating jump-in meal, because it's one of these techniques. Once you have the technique down for risotto, you can make it in any season. So, again, if you go to the harvest eating website, there should be several recipes for it, but it is terrific in all seasons and just about with any type of protein. And one that I really like is, I'm just going to give you, there's a lot of, I'm sure your show is made up of quite a few men, but here's a great risotto. Let's say you're again, cooking with inexpensive cuts like chuck. If you use chuck roast and you make stews, you can take, you always usually have some leftover stew. You can take that liquid, because when you make a stew, you're braising. There's going to be a lot of flavorful liquid. And when you're done with that stew, when we make it, we'll probably cook 4 or 5 pounds of chuck. We always have a big pot of it left over that we eat later on, you know, for lunch or whatever. You can take those ingredients with a little extra beef broth, and you can make pot roast risotto, which is just out of this world. And the basic technique for risotto is totally different than what we talked about with paella and arroz con pollo, where essentially what you add all of the liquid or broth to those rice dishes, and then you let it evaporate at once. When you're making risotto, this is totally different, and you have to note that it's a different rice. This is short grain rice, and this comes from usually the Po River Valley in Italy. It's not a long, you can't make this with long white rice. I store sushi rice, and I store risotto grains, which are just a short rice. They've got a lot of starch in them, and when you cook these, it's very simple. Start, again, with that same Dutch oven, good quality olive oil, aromatics, onions and garlic, and then once you cook your aromatics a little bit, you're going to throw in your risotto, and it's called arborio. That's the type of rice, arborio rice. Once you throw that in there, what you'll do is, again, you'll cook it. You're not going to brown it, but you're going to cook it and stir it constantly for a few minutes just down in the oil, and it's going to change color a little bit. It's going to go kind of a little opaque on you. And once you do that, now we're going to make this pot roast risotto. Take the liquid and any of the vegetables and basically drain the whole thing, separate the meat, and then thin that mixture out with the addition of some beef stock. So let's say you take, let's say you're going to need 8 cups of liquid. Take about 4 cups of your pot roast, thick, flavored liquid, and then add about 4 cups of beef stock, and then kind of stir it up. Now, once you cook your arborio rice down in the oil for a few minutes, now you're going to start adding additions by the ladleful. And if you have, you should try to add an 8-ounce ladle, which is a cup. If you don't have one that big, you can do 2 smaller ones. But add about a cup of liquid at a time. Once you add the liquid, you can use a wooden spoon for this. Take your wooden spoon and just stir and stir. And what's going to happen is the motion of that paddle or that spoon bumping into the grains as you continue to stir, it's going to let out a lot of starch. And it's that kind of, you know, theory has it. It's the movement of the rice hitting the spoon that helps to release a lot of that very gelatinous starch. So once it absorbs the first addition of liquid, add another one. And you keep going, and this is a great technique. You keep cooking your rice with slow additions of liquid until it becomes tender. And at the end, that's when you're going to want to add, you know, in your last addition of liquid, in this case, we would add a bunch of shredded meat, and then you could add, you know, some great fresh herbs, like in this case, a little bit of sage would be awesome, or some fresh chopped thyme. Put that in there. You could even add a little bit of Parmesan cheese, a little fresh olive oil, and then continue to stir it. And what you're going to have in this case is a pot roast risotto, rich, rich beef flavors, and definitely add those fresh herbs at the very end. And basically you have a super filling way to use up your leftover meat and just make an incredible rice dish. And you can do the same thing. Just use that theory, but you can do it with shrimp. Take shrimp, right? Take the shells off the shrimp. Put those in some liquid with a mirepoix and boil those shells and the vegetables for about 35 minutes. Strain that out. Now you've got an incredible shrimp broth. Never throw out the shells. Anytime we make shrimp, we put them in the freezer to use.
And don't throw the heads. And if you got the whole shrimp, you do the heads as well when you do that.
Absolutely. And always try to buy wild-caught shrimp, not pond-raised. So once you make that shrimp broth, you use that broth, same recipe, oil, arborio rice down in the pan, cook a little bit, and then start adding additions of your shrimp stock. And at the very end, add in your shrimp. You know, you can leave the tails on, or you can just take them off and dice the shrimp up. It's totally up to you. And then, again, at the very end, hit it maybe in this case with some fresh tarragon, which would go awesome with that, a little bit of diced tomato and maybe some diced green onion. Mix that whole thing through. Now you've got shrimp risotto, which is awesome. And you can do it with chicken. You can use mushrooms. You can use zucchinis. You can use butternut squash. You can use collard greens, artichokes, any type of seasonal vegetable throughout the year. This is a great dish for. And this is why oftentimes when I give a demonstration or I teach somebody in person some new recipes when they're first finding out about this harvest eating lifestyle, I give them these type of recipes that they can use all year long. Same technique, just with different, think seasonal, think spring, summer, fall, winter, and use what you've got and that you're getting locally, either from your own garden or from your local farmer's market, and that same risotto can transfer throughout the season. And it's really awesome. It's such a great, it's filling, I mean, and again, it's inexpensive.
And the beauty is we bring all these staples together. We come up with formulas for the staples, and then whatever's available gets tossed in. But I'm going to push you because I want to keep us rolling here. I want to move on to some stuff we can do with beans and maybe one or two because I want to hit these other things too, and we're already 30 minutes in. So let's do something with beans now.
Okay, well, one of the things with beans, a lot of people are putting up dried garbanzo beans. What you can do with those is make hummus. Hummus is an unbelievable protein source, and again, it's got Middle Eastern roots to it, so it's not going to be boring, you know, dull American food. Take those garbanzos, the dried ones, you want to soak them overnight in cold water, and then cook them, you know, for as long as it takes for them to be tender. It'll probably take a good 2 hours, or if you've got a pressure cooker, you can certainly use that, but the point is, once you've got your garbanzo beans fully cooked, and, you know, almost on the side of mushy, then you're going to make hummus. And hummus is a big-time staple in Israel and Jordan and places like that, and Tunisia, all around that Middle Eastern region. They eat a lot of hummus, and it's an awesome food. And, again, it's very versatile. On the website, there's videos and recipes for making hummus. I'll walk you through a simple roasted red pepper hummus. And one thing that really pisses me off is if you look at the varieties in the store, 10 years ago you could buy them and they had good wholesome ingredients in there. They had real olive oil, real garlic, and beans. Now you look at them, they're putting in soybean oil, dehydrated this, MSG that, and I can guarantee you, you'll never find a real Israeli or somebody that makes this with soybean oil. Never will happen.
It's sacrilegious, right? I mean, it just you just don't do that. It's like,
yeah.
I don't know, it's like serving vinegar and calling it wine.
Right. I mean, the olive oil, it is part of, like, a main component of this dish. So what you do is you take your beans, they're cooked into the food processor they go, and then there's a substance called tahini. And again, in the Middle Eastern regions, sesame seeds are ground into tahini. It's T-A-H-I-N-I. You can find it in a can. It comes in a can right above the peanut butter section in most supermarkets or any kind of specialty store. Because it's loaded with fat in the can, this is something you can put in your preps forever. This stuff will last forever. And you take this stuff in this oily sesame paste. It's delicious. You'll put the beans in there. You'll put some of the sesame paste in there. A good bit of your extra virgin. Again, this is where you use the best oil you have. Put in your good extra virgin olive oil. a boatload of fresh garlic, lemon juice, and then maybe one roasted red bell pepper that's been diced up. Throw that in there. You could add some chili peppers if you want, like maybe one either dried that's been reconstituted or a fresh chili pepper. A little bit of cilantro goes nice in that, but you don't need it. Also some parsley goes nice. And just turn the food processor on. Make sure you've got no seeds from your lemon juice. You want to use fresh squeezed lemons. That, again, the lemon juice is a big-time component. And blend this up. And it's got to be nice and thick. This stuff stores really well frozen. And once you have it, like my wife yesterday morning, she made sandwiches for her to take to work. A whole wheat tortilla with a bunch of roasted red pepper hummus. And then a lot of people are sprouting nowadays. There is no better combination. And let's do this one 100% vegetarian. Let's say that we're going to make we'll make a wrap, right? Take a wrap. You can either make your own tortilla or you can buy these, you know, whole wheat tortillas in the store. You put down a good smear of your roasted red pepper hummus, and then take whatever type of sprouts you have. We sprout broccoli sprouts, celery sprouts, buckwheat sprouts, lots of different ones. We always have a huge bag in the refrigerator. Put a ton of, like a good 2-inch layer of your sprouts on top of the hummus, and then take cucumbers and tomatoes right out of your garden. Put those in there, and then you can put, if you want some cheese, great. You don't have to put it, but a little bit of feta cheese would be awesome in there. Wrap that thing up, and that's an awesome meal, and it's got a lot of protein. Those beans definitely have a lot of protein in it, and that's hummus. And you can also use it if you have a cocktail party. Put it on the table with some crackers. You can take pita bread, rub it with a little olive oil and some garlic, and toast it in the oven, cut it up into triangles, and serve that with hummus. Kids generally will love hummus. Just avoid the spiciness, but you can do it, like I just said, with red peppers. You can do it plain. You can add extra lemon and have a lemon-flavored hummus. But hummus in itself is a great Middle Eastern recipe. It's inexpensive because it's mainly these garbanzo beans, and super delicious. Have you ever tried that?
Oh, absolutely. I love hummus. I'm a hummus fiend, and that's why when you said people are making it with soybean oil, I'm like, it's just, you know, my British friends would just say, it's just not done, mate. It's just not done. It's fabulous. And, of course, you can do an Italian variation using favas. And I think that's right. Great, because what I like to do is my, like, let's say I have a large crop, like, that's taking up a whole bed, like corn, that's very nutrient, greedy. And I've harvested that in, you know, late summer, and now I'm heading into fall, and I'm going to have that cooler weather. So I'll go and I'll sow favas in that bed. I know I'm going to get some nitrogen effect. I'm going to get a ton of organic matter. I'm going to get a harvest right before we get, you know, they'll handle the first frost. They're a traditional Italian winter crop. I want to get them in early enough that they're not going to get a heavy frost, because that'll kill them. I'm going to get a harvest of favas. They're another great prep bean. And I can follow your exact same recipe. It's going to be different. I almost don't want to call it hummus, because I'm like a hummus junkie, but it's the Italian variation thereof. So we can do a lot with, again, taking one technique and using different base materials.
Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely a reason why we store beans, and why, you know, for thousands of years, these legumes have been a major diet in almost every culture, because they're super nutritious, they're filling, they've got protein in them. I mean, that's the one thing that people need is, you know, protein is definitely a good fuel, and also fat. Do not be afraid of fat. When you need to sustain yourself, like those people that hike Mount Everest and all those places, they're eating just gazillions of calories from fat in those base camps, because the body really needs it. But again, this stuff is very nutritious. And another thing that you should have in your prep is lentils. And lentils, there is nothing like lentils. To me, the lentil is almost the king of legumes, and there's a lot of different kinds. You can get sort of the French green lentils. You can get what are called beluga lentils, which are small little black lentils. There's a lot of different kinds of lentils, and what I like to do with lentils, go ahead.
I was going to say, what I love about them as a prepper food, they store just like a bean. They have the same nutritional profile as a bean, a little bit more fat, which is good because we do need some of that, but I don't have to soak them overnight. I can just pretty much cook them when I'm ready to cook them.
Yeah, that's a great point. Same thing with like pigeon peas, things like that, or a little like a, you know, kidney bean.
Oh, really? You cook with pigeon peas?
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't know that. That's a big thing in permaculture. The permaculture folks are always using those as a nitrogen producer. I didn't know that that was a good cooking crop, so I'm going to have to look into that.
Yeah, and down here in the South, we do quite a bit with, as you know, black-eyed peas.
Black-eyed peas, cow peas, things like that.
Crowder beans or Crowder peas, those are really good. But let's talk about some lentils. And a lot of people in your audience keep chickens. Now, this is kind of this is sort of a fancy recipe, but again, it's made with very inexpensive things. If you go to France, in Europe and in France in particular, you know, if you go there, yeah, they're going to have eggs at the hotel, but they have eggs for breakfast strictly for the Americans. They do not eat eggs for breakfast. They eat them lunchtime and even more so at dinner time. And if you go to areas like Lyon, which is in the heart of Burgundy, you'll find a lot of salads that are made with lentils. Now take your French green lentils, cook them per the package directions, but you want them on the little bit on the toothy side of raw. You don't want them mushy, but you don't want them hard. You want them just a little what you would say al dente. Once you have those cooked, you want to cool them down to room temperature, and then you're going to make a very simple French mustard vinaigrette. Take a blender. Again, go to harvesteating.com. There's a video and a recipe for that. Take a blender, put in, and this is where people can change it up a bit. Shallots are very big in France and with chefs. We love our shallots because it's kind of a cross between an onion and garlic. It's just a little more mild. But take one, you know, decent-sized shallot. When you open up a shallot, there's usually, it looks like one, but there's two together, and there's some kind of paper in between. If you want to spread them apart, peel off the paper from the shallot, mince it up, and put in, you know, 2 to 3 tablespoons of minced shallot into the bottom of your blender. Put in one minced garlic clove into that blender. And then go for your high-quality French Dijon mustard. By all means, do not put that yellow hot dog mustard. You'll make me turn over in my grave when I die. Use good French Dijon mustard. Put a heaping tablespoon. Even you could put 2 tablespoons, but a heaping tablespoon right down in there, and then look for some high-quality red wine vinegar at the store. You can certainly use champagne vinegar, which is white, but more traditional is going to be a red wine vinegar. You'll put about a good quarter cup of that red wine vinegar in there, a little bit of sea salt, some black pepper, and then you're going to cover your blender and turn it on and whiz that stuff up. It's going to get pretty thick. Whiz it up until everything's combined, and then take, you put in about a quarter cup. You're going to want about 3/4 of a cup of oil to keep around a 3-to-1 ratio. And what I like to do is I'll drizzle the first quarter cup of oil through the top blender with the blender running. I'll use my good high-quality extra virgin, but too much extra virgin can overpower this. So use a quarter cup of extra virgin and drizzle it in slowly into the top of the blender with it running on high. That's going to create an emulsification, which is a thickening process. And then add pure olive oil, or you could even use grapeseed oil in the rest. And that'll be in about a half a cup. And then you should have a good, thick French mustard vinaigrette. So now you've got two components. You've got your cooked green lentils at room temperature. You've got your mustard vinaigrette. Make sure you taste it for salt and pepper. Set those aside. And now you want to go out to your chicken coop and get a couple of beautiful, fresh chicken eggs, and you want to poach them. I won't tell people how to poach eggs. Pretty darn simple. But for this, you don't want them runny. You want to poach them a little past runny. You know, maybe like a medium well. Want it to run just a little bit, but not a lot. So what you'll do is poach those eggs, and you'll serve this on a plate, and you can make a mold of the lentils or just do it very country style. Spoon the lentils out, and then you're going to take your poached egg or two, put them right on top of the lentils, and then you're going to hit it with some fresh cracked black pepper. And then some mustard vinaigrette, like a tablespoon of that mustard vinaigrette right down on top of the eggs, and then some minced fresh chives. Serve that. You can take a little baguette and toast it in the oven with a little bit of butter and a good red wine. And Jack, it is like some of the best eating. And you can have that for dinner with a tossed green salad, and you are living large, as I like to say.
And again, very inexpensive, something that is probably a lot of peasant housewives whipping up every day in the north of France. So this is just awesome, as you always are. Let's move on to some pasta stuff.
Certainly, and I've got a lot of pasta in my...
Let's hold it to two, because we'll bring you back, man. So give us two of your best.
Okay, we talked about the risotto being a good harvest-eating jump-in technique, because you can use it with all seasonal things. Same thing with pasta. Now, this time of year, I was just in Florida, and if people listen to my podcast, the Harvest Eating Podcast, they'll hear me talk about a pasta dish I just made in Florida. I took a little 5-day quick vacation. And we grow in our garden zucchini and summer squash. And these are just beautiful vegetables. I'm really fond of these vegetables. And what I like to do is I like to make seasonal pasta. And it can be any shape of pasta. In this example, let's talk about linguine. Everyone generally has linguine. Again, it stores forever. It's cheap. And if you can stomach it, I always do, try to use whole wheat linguine, which is a little better. And you can get it in any supermarket. Barilla, I think it's called. So you get your linguine, you cook it, and then take it out of the water, rinse it off so it's like room temperature, so that's cooked. Now you want to take a pretty wide sauté pan, again, good quality extra virgin olive oil, sliced garlic. Don't mince it up because it would burn and get a little too bitter. Slice the garlic, and don't go crazy with the temperature. You want this, again, low to medium high. Put in a little bit of onion, a little bit of garlic into that olive oil. Slowly start to simmer it, and then you're going to add a little bit of fresh minced rosemary, which is that classic awesome taste. Put in a little rosemary right down in that oil. This cannot be too hot. If you burn that stuff, you got to start over. And then what you're going to do is take either zucchini or like straight-necked yellow squash and slice them up into, I don't know, eighth of an inch slices and throw them in there. What you don't want to do is put in so much that they're on top of each other and they steam. What you want to try to do is get these things colored. And a zucchini takes on a whole new life if you caramelize it slightly on the bottom, on the side, so it's got some good color to it. And try to use a young zucchini. You don't want one that has gone inside to seed. When they get real seedy and mushy, they're loaded with liquid. So you want one that's no more than 6 inches in length. So slice that sucker up and caramelize it slowly in that pan. And what I like to do is do one or the other, either zucchini or summer squash. You just have a little onions and garlic and that rosemary, or you can use parsley, but that's it. So you cook that in there, and once you've got a good color on those vegetables, now you take your pasta and then you toss it right back into the pot. You can put a teeny bit, maybe a tablespoon of dry white wine there, and then this is where you want to reach for your Parmesan cheese. And this is another thing that keeps for a good long time. And take your good Parmesan cheese. It could be Wisconsin Parmesan cheese, which is excellent stuff, by the way. And take that cheese and grate a bunch of it over the top, salt and black pepper, and then take your tongs. You can cook the pasta just for, remember, we already cooked it, but you want to cook it on low heat just for 3 or 4 minutes, and you want to toss all those ingredients together. Serve that in the bowl with a little more fresh Parmesan cheese on top. Garnish it with a little piece of rosemary. And I got to tell you, Jack, I've made this dish, and a lot of your listeners are totally preconditioned to this phony American-Italian food, which is spaghetti with like a giant pile of, 2 gallons of watery red sauce on top. This is not how they eat in Italy. Now, what I just described to you, the pasta, that's the main dish. The other things are what they call the condimento. It's the additions, but that scenario right there is the ultimate in summer. You've got that rosemary. You've got either zucchini or summer squash. A little bit of that cheese. You toss that together, and at first, people are going to look at it, they're going to think, well, there's no tomato sauce on it. But then when you try it, remember that cheese, good quality Parmesan cheese has a nutty quality. It almost tastes like hazelnuts. And then awesome. You've got the caramelized zucchini in there. and some of that texture from that whole wheat pasta. And again, this is where once you serve it, take your good quality oil raw and do a little drizzle on the top with some white wine of your choice. It is an awesome summertime dish, and it's something that you can also serve, you know, at room temperature. This doesn't need to be served blazing hot. Like on a hot afternoon, there's nothing better, 1 or 2 o'clock in the afternoon, have a room temperature bowl of what I just described with a little bit of white wine and kick your darn shoes off and take a nap. And that's a great dish. And again, you can just take that similar technique. Remember what we did. We cooked pasta and it can be any shape. Let's say that we switch to farfalle, which are the bow ties. Cook off some of those. Let's say we're in the beginning of spring. You've got some fresh mushrooms, or better yet, you reach into your preps, you take out your dried mushrooms, which last forever. Those things are kind of mummified. You rehydrate them with some boiling water ahead of time, and then do the same exact thing in the pan, olive oil, a little bit of onion, a little bit of garlic, throw in your rehydrated mushrooms and the tips of some beautiful fresh asparagus, throw in your bow ties, warm it all up, a little bit of white wine, Parmesan cheese. There you got another killer spring pasta dish. I just gave you a summer one. You can use, in the fall, you can throw butternut squash in there. You can use some greens go great in there. Like you can cook some slow-cooked greens in there, or arugula, or things like, what is that? Help me out, Jack. What's that that little
chard?
Cabbage.
Oh,
well, chard would be super.
I know you're talking about, like a radicchio.
Radicchio, yeah, sorry.
Oh, man, yeah.
Or radicchio, olive oil, and you can put that down it right in the pan with some olive oil and garlic and just cook that radicchio, again, until the bottom gets a good crispness on it. You don't need to cook it on one side. Take it, dice it up, and then put your pasta in with that, some Parm cheese, a little white wine. You are just living large. So you do this all season long. You're cooking with your pasta that's in storage, you're adding seasonal vegetables and things that you're getting locally from farmers market. Hopefully you'll have some dried mushrooms, hopefully some of these other ingredients you're going to be able to store. And let's say you don't have fresh garlic. You can use a little bit of powdered garlic, or you can use some of the herbs. Like sometimes I get a little lazy. We make a spice blend, Jack, called Northern Italian. And
yep.
That one has, it's got dried porcini
mushrooms.
Porcini mushrooms,
and I love that one of your, the two that I love the most are the Northern Italian and the Montreal steak. And like I've said before about your Montreal steak, it's like, folks, if you guys haven't tried this yet from Keith, you've got to do it. If you bought like the McCormick crap or something like that in the supermarket and you think that's what Montreal steak seasoning is, it almost bears, there's a few things that are in there that are in both as far as the ingredients, but it bears almost no resemblance. I haven't cooked a piece of red meat yet with that, and I've cooked it with lamb. I've done that with, I've done brisket, and I thought, let's just try something different. Let's use this as a rub on a hickory smoked brisket. That was fabulous. So those two you gotta add to your pantry. We're actually running a bit long. I got an idea. What do you think about this, Keith? We'll talk a little bit about using some canned foods and wrap this up, and maybe schedule your other stuff for a second interview.
Sounds awesome.
Because we're at like 53 minutes here.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I could talk about food forever. Well, yeah, again, canned things. Like just this morning I was organizing. We've got these rolling racks with a lot of canned goods on them. And, again, you talk about, it's very critical. Eat what you store, store what you eat. You cannot wake up one day and realize you've got to cook with these things and not have any idea because you spend 5 days a week eating out, or your wife is cooking for you only, or you're not, you know, you're eating fast food or takeout. You've got to practice cooking. This is a skill that is critical. Because remember, aside from water, the next thing is food, and I don't think anybody can afford to live for any length of time on the food that comes from these companies, because it is darn expensive. But you're going to have to learn to cook. This is a critical skill. So having the skill and then applying it to the things in your prep, canned goods. Today, I was looking, we've got, you know, probably 100 cans of black beans. You can make black bean burgers, Jack. Take your canned black beans, drain out the liquid, smash them up in a food processor, and then put aromatics like onions and garlic and some celery in there, a little bit of cornmeal, and a couple of egg whites, right? You can take that and make hamburgers out of it. It's meatless, but loaded with protein. And a little fresh cilantro is great in there as well.
And let me say, I'll eat that, and those veggie burgers from the store, you couldn't pay me to eat one of those crappy things. But if you do that, what you're talking about right there with black beans, I'll throw that on the grill. I'll put a slice of tomato and some red onion on that, and I'll eat that on a whole wheat bun happily. It's not the same as meat. That's not the point. But it tastes really, really good. It's full of nutrition.
Yeah, and again, one more slam on the corporate food. Years ago, when those veggie burgers came out, they used to be half decent, and then the food scientist got a hold of them. My neighbor had some, and she was going to serve it to my kids the other day when she was watching them, and I said, "Have you read the ingredients? What do you mean? It's veggie burger. I mean, that thing, there's like 65 ingredients in there. It's a science project."
Yeah, I mean, when people say it's all vegetarian or all natural, I'm like, let me give you some all vegetarian, all natural things you could be eating. How about poison ivy? You want some of that? It's all natural. It's all vegetarian. And it's just to make a point that just because it's all something doesn't mean it's good. And I love the people that are like, I have all vegetarian chicken. The chicken was fed all vegetation. That's not what a chicken is supposed to freaking eat. It's an omnivore, and this universal all of anything or all natural, that's always sets off my skeptic button because nature doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's a great point. When you go into the store, anything, you've got to read, and you've got to remember that I'm in the food business too. I make a line of, we just talked about the spices, but I also have a line of pasta sauces. So I know what the FDA laws are with labeling. You can get away with murder. I don't have to list just about, there's loads of things I can put in there under the term natural flavors. Now, anybody that reads that, oh, it's natural flavors. You can put almost 2,000 different things that can go under that natural flavor umbrella that are not natural. So you've got to read your labels.
Dirt would be a natural flavoring as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. Horse manure is natural.
What else can we do with canned foods, man? What else we got?
Well, before we go, we just made those bean burgers. Okay. Put those on a toasted bun and make cilantro mayonnaise. Take some mayonnaise, put some mint cilantro lime in there, melted cheddar cheese on that bean burger, you're living large. One more thing with your canned food. A lot of people love those canned potatoes, and you know they just sit in there, and you just kind of stare at them. You don't know what to do with them. Those are cooked through, but they have an interesting texture. Take those canned potatoes out, slice them up, and then make a ham and potato casserole. And this is one that I credit my mother-in-law. This is definitely a Bavarian-style recipe, and it's on the website. Take a bunch of those potatoes, and then you know a leftover ham hock. And this is what kills me. People take these things, Jack, and they throw them out. They just take like the easy to get meat and they toss it. Don't toss that thing. Take it and pick it. And you can pick lots of little bits of ham off that thing. And then take that ham and those potatoes and make a simple white sauce, a bechamel. Or you just basically take some flour, cook in a pan with a little fat, add some milk to it, a bay leaf, cook that thing down until it gets a little thick. You add the milk, the flour in there thickens it up. There's a recipe on the website. And then combine the ham, potatoes, and sliced white onions together in a casserole. Put it in the oven for 25 or 30 minutes until it just starts to brown. Dude, you put that together with a nice beer, you're living, man. Every time my mother-in-law makes that, I watch her. I'm like, what are you doing? She says, what? I'm like, that's not enough. There won't even be any leftovers. Come on. make a tray of that stuff. But that's a killer dish to use those white potatoes for.
Awesome. Yeah, I mentioned those before when we were chatting before we got online, and pretty much what I do with them is just, you know, saute them with a little butter, garlic, rosemary, and they're great that way. But what another way to like take it to another level, and that's what I love about having you on. You got one more canned food thing for us and we'll wrap up this episode?
Yeah, you give me a canned item. Let me see if I can come up with something.
Okay, let's say, one of the things I like, you have to read the labels to avoid the fructose corn syrup because I don't know why, but suddenly this is in like half at least of the brands of them. Just crushed tomatoes because that's something that we have tons of, you know, the diced tomatoes that maybe have peppers and onions in with them. There's a billion variations of them, but the diced canned tomatoes.
Yeah, that's a good one. What I like to make with nice canned tomatoes, just made it the other day, the herb tarragon, very underused, either dry or fresh. Get a little bit of that. Take a pan. This is a simple one-pot soup that will, it will make Campbell's run and hide under a rock, because that Campbell's stuff is trash. You want to take those canned tomatoes, right? You start out with one pot butter. Don't use olive oil here. Put in a good half a stick of butter, about a quarter of a cup of very finely minced onion, a half of a garlic clove, and saute that in the pot. You don't want to color it. Just when it goes translucent, you'll dump all of those tomatoes in there. They can be, and you want all the juice too. You can use whole peeled tomatoes. You can use crushed tomatoes. You can use diced tomatoes, but put all the juice in there. And what you're going to do, I forgot one step. Before you throw those tomatoes in there, and you've got all that butter and the onions and garlic, you'll put about 2 tablespoons of sifted flour on top of that. Stir it for another minute to cook out some of the cakey, floury taste. Dump your tomatoes in there and about 1 cup of real heavy cream. And try to buy the organic kinds. Put that in there, salt and pepper, and the fresh or dried tarragon. Let that cook, literally, Jack, 10 minutes. That's it. Just needs to come up to a simmer. And then if it's if you don't have crush, you're going to take your stick blender or transfer it to your blender, process it down until it's smooth. You serve that up with a grilled cheese sandwich. It's heaven. It's such an easy cream of tomato soup, and that tarragon is magic in there. People are not used to that herb. It is, I'm telling you, it is magic. Anytime I give that to people, they're like, oh, my God, what is that?
Yeah, so somebody at Campbell's. Somebody at Campbell's marketing just jumped off the ledge of a building down in Madison Avenue when you said that. And the tarragon and tomato does go awesome together. You sent me one of your new pasta sauces that has the tarragon in it, and it's just absolutely fabulous blending those two flavors together. And it is something most people aren't interested in, or not interested right. in. I say don't know about is probably a better way to put it. Well, man,
yeah,
go ahead.
I was going to say, you've got to spread your wings, people. Learn to expand your culinary inventory. Learn how to cook. It's a critical skill. And if you blend that together with the advice that Jack is giving you, you're going to be much better off if anything happens. Before I go, Jack, I just want to say thank you so much to all of your TSB fans, because they have been really, really gracious and very supportive of what I'm doing over at Harvest Eating. They're subscribing to my podcast. They're buying the products. They're taking great time and making posts on the Facebook page. You guys have been awesome, so hats off to you TSP people.
Hey, Keith, and you had some a special for your membership that you were going to offer for TSP members today?
Yeah, we give a pretty good discount. If you click the graphic on Jack's site, you'll go over, and we offer all of our membership plans with a good discount. Like the Lifetime plan is the most popular one. Instead of $200, it's $169. We send you a big box of goodies. You'll get 6 bags of the spices we talked about. You'll get 4 jars of the pasta sauce. You'll get an autographed cookbook. It's like a 20-pound box shipped right to your house, plus lifetime access to all of my recipes and all the features of Harvest Eating. And then we offer a yearly and a monthly plan as well.
Folks, the lifetime is a freaking deal. The cookbook alone is absolutely fabulous. I went out and got a copy for myself because I love what Keith's doing and I wanted to support him. But when I got it, it's not your typical cookbook. The thing could be a coffee table book. The illustration, or I should say the photography in it, is absolutely fabulous, and it'll make your mouth water just like listening to Keith today on the show. We only got through about half of what I wanted to talk about, Keith, so I definitely want to get you back on for a second interview. I'm sure you're up for that.
Yeah, I did that on purpose, Jack.
Well, that's the plan, you know. We will wrap up with that. Keith, you got any final thoughts for folks before I let you go?
No, just make sure you guys are taking this advice and getting prepared for what may come, and I definitely want to invite people to subscribe to my podcast. And again, just thanks so much. And Jack, we're all of us TSP fans are happy that you're settled into Arkansas, and I want to wish, and I'm sure the fans do, that you have an incredibly relaxing vacation.
Yeah, I'm right now, as people are actually hearing this, not while we're doing it, I'm probably trying.
Oh yeah,
I'm probably right now, as people are hearing this for the first time, trying to lure a snook to suck down a piece of whitebait or something like that. And it's been a long time coming. It's been a year since I've really had any time off. So I appreciate your sentiments there, and thank you for that. And thank you for being on the show again, Keith. You've been a real friend to the show. You've been a great supporter of the show, a great sponsor, and you're always welcome here on the Survival Podcast.
Thanks so much, Jack.
And with that, folks, this has been Jack Spirico today, along with Chef Keith Snow, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
Well, thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Survival Podcast, Friday Flashbacks. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider becoming an MSB member. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and click on members to learn more. You can also support our show by going to T-Spaz, that's T-S-P-A-Z, T-Spaz.com. Anytime you shop online, and while you'll support us no matter what you buy, you will find over 500 reviews of items I have personally tested and vouched for. And to stay in touch with us and never miss anything, follow our channel or our group on Telegram. You can find links to that and all our social media options. Just go to thesurvivalpodcast.com and check the show notes for any episode.